Paper 119. We're on section 2, which is at the bottom of old single column, page 1310. Okay, so you have these first three bestowals, where he's bestowing himself as three different types of local universe sons: Melchizedek son, a Lenonidek son, and then a material son. And we did the Melchizedek son in the first bestowal last week, so let's just jump right in and see where this next bestowal takes us. Who'd like to read? You want to read?
Sure.
2, the second bestowal. For almost 150 million years after the Melchizedek bestowal of Michael, all went well in the universe of Nebadon when trouble began to brew in System 11 of Constellation 37. This trouble involved a misunderstanding by a Lenonidek son, a system sovereign, which had been adjudicated by the Constellation Fathers and approved by the Faithful of Days, the Paradise Counselor to that constellation. But the protesting system sovereign was not fully reconciled to the verdict. After more than 100 years of dissatisfaction, he led his associates in one of the most widespread and disastrous rebellions against the sovereignty of the Creator Son ever instigated in the universe of Nebadon, a rebellion long since adjudicated and ended by the action of the Ancients of Days on Yversa. This rebel system sovereign, Lutentia, reigned supreme on his headquarters planet for more than 20 years of standard Nebadon time, whereupon the Most Highs, with approval from Yversa, ordered his segregation and requisitioned the Salvington rulers for the designation of a new system sovereign to assume direction of that strife-torn and confused system of inhabited worlds.
Okay. So, setting the stage here in those first two paragraphs, and just a couple things to notice in contrast to the third rebellion, the rebellion in our system, and how many differentials there are between how it played out. Remember that this first one is just that. It's the first one. It's way back. All Michael has done is that first bestowal. He's still very much going to be in the state that he was in, like we pointed out, for ever since he arrived in on Salvington 300 billion years ago. He's just the vicegerent of the Universal Father still, pretty much. He's got one bestowal experience under his belt, but it's still going to be in a pretty hands-off mode. And you really see this in how long this is playing out. So, it starts out with, so there's this adjudication of this little issue that this system sovereign is having. But he's stewing with it, okay? And he's just not, happy with it. And look at the timescale. Okay, 100 years, and you notice they're still speaking in local universe standard time here. So, it's about 500 years, okay, where, obviously the whole character of the system is going to be a bit fuzzy if he's stewing with this. So, when they're just letting that go for 500 years, and then... even when he finally decides, he's at it, and he's just going to rebel, he still reigns supreme on his headquarters planet for more than 20 years, 100 years, before they got clamped down before they shut the circuits down. So very interesting, you know. I mean, everyone remembers how it worked in ours. I mean, just the moment that Lucifer stepped forward, boom! Now they clamped the system down. Yeah, the Most High put a lid on it, and the whole span of time from, you know, when he declared until Laniforge arrived was just about 2 years of our time.
So, pretty quick. Even in a perfected system in a high order with a higher order of beings, you still have this stopgap between the betrayal and the ultimate time when hopefully it catches up with them.
You obviously have those basic issues in play. I mean, you know how just in general this works, and then on top of it, the way Michael has a tendency to, you know, to conduct his local universe. I mean, yeah, all those things are in play. But there's a definite progression that occurs, you know, over the course of these seven bestowals. You know, the whole local universe is slowly, you know, solidifying into a more definitive expression. And it shows up in issues just like this. As you go from Rebellion 1 to 2 to 3, you know, there's a clamping down going on, at this point, this very first one, there's no precedent, so everyone would just be kind of stepping back and waiting, to see, well, what's Michael going to say, Whereas there would have been much more tendency on the part of the Verandadex to know what the precedent was, when it came to ours, and to step in and be more direct about it, not overstepping their bounds, obviously, but anyway, just notice that one little detail. So it's worth pointing that out.
You expressed it as a clamping down. Mm-hmm. Could it be more like, I see it more as a focusing.
Right. Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, clamping may be a little bit too strong in the case of Michael's local universe, but nonetheless, I mean, if it's not an actual clamping down, there's a potential clamping down. Like now that he's a master son, sovereign, he can deal with anything summarily. So the potential to clamp down is fully activated now. And all the subordinate personalities, will be functioning in that mode. They're going to make a point as we go through this about how significant the changes were in the whole administration of the local universe as you're going through these seven bestowals. It's radically transforming the entire administration, how everyone is doing everything in the local universe as you go from bestowal to bestowal. It's a very, very significant phenomenon, to just recognize. And it has a lot to do with appreciating that we live in an experiential domain. Reality is experiential. That's an important thing to learn from the fifth epical revelation. That initial impression that you might get from your initial faith grasp and your initial connection with God the Father, which can lead to a sense of you can turn things on a dime. Especially if you had a real epiphany event, if you as an individual, I was going along lost, and then one day I was found, and everything was different in my life after that. People who have had those very definitive, transformative events in their life, their initial sense of God is you connect with God and the finger snaps are what it's all about. See, and that gives you a bit of a false impression about the way the super universe level works. you know, like we pointed out, I mean, even though it's not exactly 200 billion years ago when that first world was, you know, if you just take that as a given number, you know, for 199 billion years, there was, you know, it was in a very much, well, there's that Michael guy, and he came from paradise, and he kind of sits in his ivory tower on Salvington, and, we murmur about it some, you know, and finally all that murmuring, you know, came to its first head here, you know, and rebellion broke out. Just think about those sorts of timescales, and it puts the 200,000 years, you know, for us in a better context. It's a really short period of time relative to, not 1,000 times more than that, but 1,000,000,000 times more than that, sort of timescales, you know, where things are playing out very, very glacial evolutional processes.
So there were no rebellions prior to his.
I'll go ahead and just mention right now since you said that. Yeah, that's one of the things. Coincidentally, just as he's doing his seven bestowals, the three rebellions match up. You know, you can ponder that little fact, how that works. What's chicken, what's egg, what's neither? What's just the hand of supremacy that things just work out as they need to? Since you went all that time and, you know, here just... not only within the span of the seven bestowals, but timed so that they're spaced evenly, roughly. See, I mean, there's just a number of temporal coincidences here that are curious.
Are you hinting that they're allowing these things to happen, right?
Well, they certainly allow them to happen. I'm not hinting anything. I'm just pointing out that there's, you know, you got some mysterious temporal synchronicity going on here where, you know, no one is manipulating this rebellion to occur right when they know that it's about time for Michael to do another bestowal and he'll probably step in. I mean, you know, there's nothing, you know, interventionary, manipulative, micromanagement like going on. It's just coincidentally in the wholeness of things. That which is needed when it's needed is there.
There could be some maturation cycle of a local universe that we don't know anything about. And it takes that much time before things coalesce to a certain point to where it's right for him to make his first bestowal.
Right. I mean, there obviously has to be something like that, you know. But then why it took, you know, why did it take that long for someone to rebel?
One thing we don't know whether there weren't some planetary rebellions
before. Yeah, there might have been some lesser things, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
There's some statements within the book that, reading between the lines, you get the idea there have been planetary rebellions in various systems where there haven't been.
Yeah, and if not an actual rebellion, a default, and Adam and Eve, you know, certainly could have defaulted.
Right.
So,
if the entire inhabited realm was compared to a year, it would be like a rebellion happening late on December 29th for the first rebellion in time, and this other one happened like it literally at 11:30 or 11:45, you know, or the last few seconds.
Yeah. Right. So. Yeah, it's very, very end-loaded here, you know, all these phenomena. There's no doubt about it. Yeah, Jason?
Chris, could that be due to why he had rebellions, or because he had rebellions earlier, that he had to have his bestowal sooner?
We just don't know much of anything. Oh. Yeah, it's very, very limited information to go on. Yeah, so.
Say, from one point of view, these rebellions are because of a person making a decision.
Worse, a choice.
A choice, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I mean, just, you know, you can see there's, you know, this is one of the things that seems to be just a natural part of what's of how they do these presentations. It's just open for lots and lots of speculation because there's so little to, you know, to work with. And you could say, well, that's just because of the revocatory mandate, but it may not be totally. I mean, some of the things they may just decided to not talk about and leave it, you know, because they do suggest at times, you know, well, we don't want to tell you everything. You know, we could, but, you know, tell you more here, but you guys should run with it a little bit. So, all right.
Simultaneously with the reception of this request on Salvington, Michael initiated the second of those extraordinary proclamations of intention to be absent from the universe headquarters for the purpose of doing the bidding of my paradise father, promising to return in due season and concentrating all authority in the hands of his paradise brother, Emmanuel, the Union of Days. And then, by the same technique observed at the time of his departure in connection with the Melchizedek bestowal, Michael again took leave of his headquarters sphere. 3 days after this unexplained leave-taking, there appeared among the reserve corps of the primary Lenonidic sons of Nebadon a new and unknown member. This new son appeared at noon, unannounced and accompanied by a lone tertiophim who bore credentials from the Uversa Ancients of Days, certified by Emmanuel of Salvington, directing that this new son be assigned to System 11 of Constellation 37, as the successor of the deposed Lutentia, and with full authority as acting system sovereign, pending the appointment of a new sovereign. For more than 17 years of universe time, this strange and unknown temporary ruler administered the affairs and wisely adjudicated the difficulties of this confused and demoralized local system. No system sovereign was ever more ardently loved or more widespreadly honored and respected. In justice and mercy, this new ruler set the turbulent system in order, while he painstakingly ministered to all his subjects, even offering his rebellious predecessor the privilege of sharing the system throne of authority, if he would only apologize to Emmanuel for his indiscretions. But Lutentia spurned these overtures of mercy, well knowing that this new and strange system sovereign was none other than Michael, the very universe ruler whom he had so recently defied. But millions of his misguided and deluded followers accepted the forgiveness of this new ruler, known in that age as the savior sovereign of the system of Polonia.
Okay. So, yeah, you just got this tiny little snippet, of course, again, about the details. But, you know, so he shows up amongst the reserves there at the constellation. You know, you've got all these Lenonidecs are distributed out to the constellations, you know, with reserves at each constellation headquarters so that, you know, they're relatively close by. If anything is needed in a system, you can... You know, they don't have to all come from Salvington. They can disperse out, you know. So he shows up amongst the reserves there. And just like with the Melchizedek, he's exactly, you know, as he should be for a Lenonidec of Nebadon. You know, you've got kind of a similar time scale going on here with in terms of how long the bestowal is, you know, like the first one. You know, it's in that 100-year ballpark. You know, not very long, but very, very efficient. You know, it's a lot like when you're thinking about the maturing Jesus. You know, he was an overachiever in every milestone. You know, how long it took him to get to receiving his adjuster, et cetera, you know. So, you know, he's always functioning in, you know, at the supremacy level of what he's doing. You know, it's going to be at the total maximization of the phenomenon. You know, no one could possibly, no Lenonidek could possibly do it as efficiently and swiftly as he did. You know, because remember, what's going on here is, first and foremost, he's trying to acquire a literal measure of the supreme type deity that that's going to be bonded to his nature. And that's why the name changes. He's literally of a different nature when he's done with this, and he's doing it seven components at a, in sequence, not all at once, building it up sequentially. So, you know, it's always, you know, supremacy is always in play, and that's just, you know, again, just little details like that. Just, you know, stop and think about, you know, 17 years. What does that tell me? It seems like a really short period of time. Oh, it seems like a really short period of time. Yeah. You know, and of course, it's only 85 years in, you know, in our time. You know, it's still a pretty short period of time. So,
not only did he extend every measure of mercy possible, but he told the tension with two words: "I'm sorry."
Yeah. And we're going to talk about, you know, that little issue coming up here in just in a little bit. We want to talk, spend some time on that, because that's a key thing to really think about. This issue of rebellion and iniquity. Yeah, just a second, Jason, here.
It says, simultaneously with the reception of the request, mm-hmm. Michael, he was totally Johnny on the spot,
yeah,
aware of everything, waiting for the request, and then simultaneously with the request, he took action.
Right, and that's, and that ties in a little bit what, you know, we pointed out in the beginning there. You have this long, protracted, obvious conclusion building. I mean, you know, to anyone on high watching Lutentia, I mean, they know where this, you know, simmering in his own juices is going. You know, it can only lead to one thing. And so, you know, he was right there. You know, he and Gabriel, obviously, and Emmanuel had totally talked this out, and this is what he was going to do, and boom, you know, so. But still, you know, the fact that it's, you know, with the reception of this request on Salvington. Notice how, even when it's a simultaneous thing, like he is, he's not usurping the system. So there's always, you know, and that's, you know, that's just like the, you know, it's not yet my hour sort of a thing. You know, we try to point out he's always going to be synchronizing with the process, you know, of the local universe, outside of that immediate circumscribed area where he is, you know, intervening. But beyond that immediate little circle, you know, like when they tried to get him to do something besides be a spiritual uplifter, help us with economic theory or something, you know, he said, no, you figure that out yourself. You know, so he's always working in a very, you know, definitive, interventionary space. You know, and you can just imagine that if he were to go outside of that bounds, he'd be in rebellion. You know, and I'm sure some of the times these things are very, very subtle, and only with a really objective perspective can you see that little trivial thing is not a trivial point. If he were to do something with that little thing, that would, you know, be a rock thrown in the pond that would send ripples that would cause issues. So I'm sure he's very, very careful, you know, about what he does in a fiat way. let's see, is there anything else in there it's all obvious, you know, pretty straightforward, the stories. You know, and the story is always very similar. No system sovereign was ever more ardently loved, etc. You know, that's always going to be just like with the Melchizedek one. Because again, that's proof that he's achieved what he was attempting to do. Do it at the supreme level. Do it at the maximization level.
Chris, it doesn't seem like an apology is enough.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, it's not. But see, that's part of the point. I mean, you know, that he's, there is, you know, mercy to the nth power being offered here. You know, so much mercy, our first inclination is, well, I don't know, I think I'd smite him. You know, you know, I mean, you can just imagine how much chaos this has caused, right? You know, and he's just saying, well, if you just say you're sorry.
It's not like a surface treatment. If a Lanonadec apologizes, it would have to be an authentic event.
Let's not run off of that too much, because like I said, I want to actually talk about the details of that a little bit in a minute when we have a little more context here.
And then came that eventful day on which there arrived the newly appointed system sovereign, designated by the universe authorities as the permanent successor of the deposed Lutentia. And all Polonia mourned the departure of the most noble and the most benign system ruler that Nebadon had ever known. He was beloved by all the system and adored by his fellows of all groups of the Lanonadec sons. His departure was not unceremonious. A great celebration was arranged when he left the system headquarters. Even his erring predecessor sent this message: "Just and righteous are you in all your ways. While I continue in rejection of the paradise rule, I am compelled to confess that you are a just and merciful administrator."
Okay, so we're going to stop there before we read that last thing. This is a point we've touched upon a little bit, and let's spend a little time on this. Before we talk about some of the specifics there, the thing to do is to drop back into, let's see, it's paper 54, isn't it? Yeah, paper 54, section 3, which is old single column, page 615. And I'm going to read you two paragraphs that are related to this. They make a little statement, an aside, about this whole issue of iniquity and what it looks like. And it's worth spending a little time so that this is appreciated, because it's the fact of iniquity is really quite different than what humans have attached to that word. In a lot of cases. And so let's think about this a little bit. Okay, so in that section 3 there, the time lag of justice, the last two of those three paragraphs say the following: "Although conscious and wholehearted identification with evil, sin, is the equivalent of non-existence, annihilation, there must always intervene between the time of such personal identification with sin and the execution of the penalty, the automatic result of such a willful embrace of evil, a period of time of sufficient length to allow for such an adjudication of such an individual's universe status as will prove entirely satisfactory to all related universe personalities, and which will be so fair and just as to win the approval of the sinner himself. But if this universe rebel, against the reality of truth and goodness, refuses to approve the verdict, and if the guilty one knows in his heart the justice of his condemnation, but refuses to make such confession, then must the execution of sentence be delayed in accordance with the discretion of the Ancients of Days. And the Ancients of Days refuse to annihilate any being until all moral values and all spiritual realities are extinct, both in the evildoer and in all related supporters and possible sympathizers." Okay, now there's a whole bunch of things there. Focus on one thing first here. This whole issue that is being brought out. See, when you, it's one thing when you're talking about a mortal. Okay, You know, if you as a mortal so consecrate yourself to nothingness that you literally evaporate the last measure of value and reality out of your soul, so it's an empty husk, and the electron microscopes of the ancients of days, i.e. the universal sensors, you know, peer into it and find it, you know, of zero weight, then, you know, you're done. Okay? Yeah, it's a pretty straightforward thing, because this is very definitive fact. You've got this, there's a vessel of value that's going to survive. All of this stuff is not going anywhere except, you know, back to the energy source from which it came. But you've got this vessel, and if the vessel's empty, then there's no you. There's no resurrection. Okay. When you're dealing with a being that doesn't have a body, that just naturally dies, like you and I, and this whole issue of transferring value into a vessel that doesn't unravel and all that sort of stuff. You know, when you're dealing with a being like Lutentia or like Lucifer, where they have to be shut off, you know, the executioners have to come in and just pull the plug on that body, on that energy individuation. Notice how this works. I mean, how do you know if you've got, you know, complete iniquity? Or maybe, complete's not even the right word, maybe, I don't know, genuine iniquity, right? Definitive iniquity. But if the universe rebel against the reality of truth and goodness refuses to approve the verdict, and if the guilty one knows in his heart the justice of his condemnation, but refuses to make such confession, okay, so he, look at what's going on there. You've got an individual who fully recognizes, he knows in his heart the justice of his condemnation. He recognizes that that this is a just thing to do, but he is not ready to go along with it yet. And so he's not executed. Well, why? I mean, what's the deal there? I mean, it seems like they're splitting hairs, aren't they? No, because it's not just a matter of him recognizing that he's nothing. He has to choose that nothingness wholeheartedly. It has to be a choice, a last choice. Okay? See, I mean, he's only recognized as being iniquitous when you go, see, when you think, why did they put in parentheses annihilation? You know, you've taken it to nothingness, you know, is literally what that word means, you know, nihil, you know, nothing. You know, he has to choose wholeheartedly, literally, the nothingness. Not just recognize it, he has to choose it. Yeah. See, you know, because that's what we're talking about. We're not just talking about evil. We're talking about sin. Like then, that's why they put that in parentheses, you know, to remind you. You're talking about choice. Choice with you know, that is conscious. You know exactly what you're choosing. You're choosing that which you know to be bad. You know it's a wrong choice. Yeah, but you're choosing it anyway. That's the difference between evil and sin. And then if you just take it to the wholehearted state, you know, then you can take sin to iniquity. Mm-hmm. No, yeah.
The part you read, mm-hmm, the first time I'd realized, mm-hmm, that it's not just that entity, but all of the
right
ones, right, that have been affected, that they also have to wait,
right,
to resolve.
Right, and that, yeah, like I said, there's a bunch of things here. So, yeah, we can go to that next stage. But I wanted to just clear up the individual first, okay? I mean, you know, the first question is, what defines iniquity in an individual? Okay? Then you have the question of when do the Ancients of Days, you know, act? I mean, you know that Lucifer has been recognized by everyone now to be iniquitous. You know, there's no more sympathy for the devil, quote unquote, you know, going on with Lucifer. But you know that all of this secondary stuff hasn't played out yet. That's why, you know, you haven't adjudicated the Third Rebellion yet. You know, and just the details of that, both in the evildoer and in all related supporters, okay, and you're still thinking, okay, that's not too complicated, and possible sympathizers? Possible sympathizers? Okay? You know, so, I mean, they're literally, the Ancients of Days are assessing this situation where they recognize at what point that no one, say, on that world forevermore is going to be a possible sympathizer. You know, it's that definitive. And that brings up some really interesting, you know, things. It's like, well, how does that work? Wouldn't it always be possible? You know, and the answer is no. I mean, like they said, you know, you know, they gave you a little clue that it's not up to the complete level yet here with the Third Rebellion, but it's getting there. You know, they've pointed out that one by one, you know, starting with Lucifer and going to others, everyone is completely clear on this. You know, you and I don't literally know Lucifer, okay, so we can't actually sympathize with him, but, you know, but, well, I mean, I don't take that all the way to the, you know, definitive, but what they're really kind of saying is, you know, in our efforts to sympathize with, you know, we've kind of been informed about Lucifer, so I could maybe sympathize with, you know, what I'm really doing is I'm sympathizing with Caligastia. You know, I'm not thinking at the system level, you know, about it, you know, I mean, there's obviously, you know, there has to be some way to measure this. You know, it has to be quantized in some way. Remember how they, you know, they tell you that the universe is wholly quantized, so that it's an ongoing concern. There has to be some way where, you know, the universal sensors can measure this, where you still have one unit in play, okay, and then it doesn't go to a half a unit, and a quarter unit, an eighth a unit, a millionth of a unit, a trillionth of a unit. You know, I mean, it doesn't go ad nauseum like that. There's got to be a point where, you know, the last unit of possibility falls, and then they adjudicate. Mm-hmm. So, exactly how you do that, I don't know. But
there's kind of a flip side that I've discovered, and it's outlined under a description of the Taconiform on page 314 and 315, and it says, "But when mercy is exhausted, when the memory thereof testifies to its depletion, then does justice prevail and righteousness decree. For mercy is not to be thrust upon those who despise it. Mercy is not a gift to be trampled underfoot by the persistent rebels of time. Nevertheless, though mercy is thus precious and dearly bestowed, your individual drawing credits are always far in excess of your ability to exhaust the reserve if you are sincere of purpose and honest of heart. So if you are not sincere of purpose or honest of heart, then where does it come down where justice will now prevail?"
Well, I mean, you know, there's two things in play with that. Like, I mean, it depends on whether you're talking about, like I said, a mortal being or an immortal being.
No, it does not talk about of time.
Right. But think about how it plays out. It plays out differently. Yes, the same principles in play, but it plays out differently. For you and I, remember, they, unless the Ancients of Days says there's nothing there, no one else is going to presume. They say they would sooner risk a system rebellion than to not resurrect an individual. So the way it works with you and I, unless it's definitive at the end of this life that your soul has zero value, you will get resurrected. It will play out. It may play out very messily on the early mansion worlds, but it will play out, and it will cease to be before Gerasim. So with you and I mean, they just let it play out. They're not going to say, you're really making it difficult for the people on the second mansion world. And so we're just going to get rid of you.
I don't know that they get rid of you, but I still think there is an element of justice.
Right. But remember, we're talking about the final justice here, though. It's going to get really gray if we're trying to try to figure out, some sort of a just penal justice. But we're talking about whether or not, they're going to turn off that Marantia being. Because once you're resurrected, okay, you're an ongoing phenomenon. That Marantia body doesn't decay because it's an artificial structure that's being sustained by the master physical controllers and the Marantia power supervisors. So again, you have to be turned off by the executioners. So you've got this issue of, there may be, an example of non-final justice is, it was about 2 years of your answer time and Lucifer was replaced. Okay, that's justice being served. It's like, okay, you're out of here. Okay, they didn't turn him off. See, so and then along comes adjudication at the time of Pentecost, and they said, okay, enough roaming around, into prison you go. They threw him on the prison world. So there's degrees where justice is being administered,
but not necessarily death.
But not the final justice.
Not the death penalty.
So there's things like you're bringing up, that you're talking about that are coming into play about, at what point do they say enough is enough and you're not going to be allowed to be system sovereign anymore? At what point is enough, you're not going to be allowed to roam around and try to convince more hapless youths, of your way? And, so a number of decision points are being made, and it's this balance between mercy and justice,
yes.
That's going along the whole way. And you know that in this local universe, it's heavy on the mercy side. They tell you that you go to another local universe where the creator son takes the other tack. And the second you squint wrong, you're done. There's this whole spectrum from extremely, on the mercy side of the justice-mercy balance to way on the justice side, where there is never a rebellion and there's not even the slightest possibility of a rebellion in some local universes, because the moment that this system sovereign starts, squinting wrong or getting, like the twitchy eye, in Clouseau, he's out of there. He's not gonna lead to a single angel going to astray. He's not gonna, So some local universes take a really strong tack. So anyway,
sympathy for a wrongdoer is, there's another side to that, which is judging the brightness of the universe.
Right, and that's and that's related to a period of time of sufficient length to allow for such an adjudication of such an individual's universe status as will prove entirely satisfactory to all related universe personalities. See, this is the level, entirely satisfactory. Not one shred of, and any angel is like, I don't know, if that was that really fair? Entirely satisfactory. So just think, in that context, I wanted to flesh that out a little bit. So now think about what's said here. What do you know about Lutentia? Why did they give this quote? Okay? Even his erring predecessor sent this message. Just and righteous are you in all your ways. While I continue in rejection of the paradise rule, I am compelled to confess that you are a just and merciful administrator. In other words, Lutentia has a wholehearted, clear vision of Michael. He knows him to be pure, and that's why he rejects him. That's iniquity. If he hadn't said that, you wouldn't have a very, it'd be fuzzy. You wouldn't really know where Lutentia was. But this is a pretty strong statement that Lutentia, if he's not at iniquity, he's darn close, okay? Because he's not using any qualifiers. You reign supreme in truth, beauty, and goodness. You are purer than I can imagine being pure. And that's why I reject you. That's iniquity. Iniquity is not ignorance. It can't be any blind spots in your vision. You have to have a completely clear vision of the goodness, and you have to engage it wholeheartedly. Right. See, because then and only then is it cosmic insanity, because this distinction is vital. We're in a cosmic system, okay? It has to be holistic. See, in order to be cosmic insanity. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, Jason.
Thank you. Chris, were you going to talk about Lutentia again?
I just did. That's what I just did.
Okay, great. Okay,
that's what we're talking about. He's the one that makes that statement.
Okay.
Right.
So I have two questions that really ask really quickly.
Okay.
The first one was why they put the T in Lutentia, and the second one is, as soon as you are apprehended to go to the prison world,
mm-hmm.
that's it, right? It's like.
Is a trial.
Is that now? Am I misinterpreting that, or is it if it's life or it's imprisonment on this prison world? And
they
can really still adjudicate.
If they're not
really. Yeah, and remember, they put him put Lucifer right. He it was deemed that he needed to be out of play, but remember, it wasn't very definitive yet at that point because there were still a bunch of people that came by and still had sympathy for him. Mm-hmm. He had visitors for quite a while. But there came to be a point, there's no more visitors now. Okay. I don't know the etymology yet of it, but you can be pretty darn certain that the T is part of the suffix, just like they did with Caligastia. They purposely gave him a non-personal suffix to indicate that, he's cosmically insane. Okay. They don't dignify him with a personal suffix of IA. They put the T on there. He's a thing. He's an entity, not a being. He's the entity that's entirely darkness. So most likely the T is part of the suffix, and the rest of it needs to be figured out what the roots of those of that word is.
So he's insane against the objective cosmic reality.
Yeah, and he has an objective assessment of that. See,
so he's absorbed all the subjectiveness. The self is where he lives. He's rejected everything else.
Well, not quite. No. See, that's what I'm trying to. The point I'm trying to make is, see, if he was wholly subjective, he couldn't make this objective choice
right.
of nothing. What he, this is the way this is working. He has to be able to see it clearly. He has to have the objective sight to see it clearly so that it's a wholehearted choice between the cosmos, which is white, and his little bubble, which is wholly black. Remember, they mentioned with Lutentia, he recognizes that this bubble is black. Okay, he recognizes that, but he's not willing to choose that yet. Over, until he's ready to choose the blackness in contrast to the white, once he makes that final choice, okay, see, then that's it. Okay, now, boom, he's just bubbled off and he's unreal now. He has no more connection to the cosmos. That's his last function of personality. And he's no longer a personal phenomenon. He's just disconnected. He's chosen to disconnect and bubble off from the Father.
In our system of justice, that is a way to get off.
Right.
By reason of insanity.
Right. Yeah, you're psychologically insane, right? Yeah. So then we'll feed you and clothe you for the rest of your life. But that's another story. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
So, right quick, would you mind running through the technical true definitions of a psychopath and sociopath?
Well, it's a little complex because it's whether or not you go bottom up or top down. But in terms of the relationship between the two, but fundamentally, you can take those words that are used, by psychologists and psychiatrists with a bit of fuzziness, and you can use the revelation to put some definitiveness to their use, so that psychopath means that the seventh agent is no longer connecting to you, so you don't have a mind of will dignity anymore. There's no Holy Spirit or Spirit of Truth, Thought Adjuster, or anything like that if there's no seventh agent. But you do have the sixth still. And so you're going to manifest, the word means soul disease, psychopath, soul disease. So it has to be something that has a relationship to what we call soul. It has to have some relationship to the sixth agent, the religious impulse. It's going to have that zeal character to it. The energy of that sixth agent is still going to be in play. It's going to be a very marauding, aggressive phenomenon. If you've dropped down even further, though, where this the sixth agent can't even connect, and you're all twisted, then you would just be a sociopath. The fifth agent, spirit of socialization, it's a social agent. So very technically, see, you would be a sociopath. But now, obviously, a psychopath is most likely also a sociopath. And it could be coming up from the bottom where you start out very distorted, and so before the sixth agent is even connected, you'd be a twisted fifth agent phenomenon, a sociopath phenomenon, and then maybe you go to a psychopath. So you could have a lot of variations on the theme. But the key is just to attach those two words to the sixth and fifth adjutants in the absence of the requisite harmonization, the symmetry of the seventh adjutant being in play. Yeah.
There are some clear delineations of a psychopath. Generally, the core, like you say, is an inability to recognize certain elements of right and wrong, a lack of sentimentality, a lack of courtesy. All of these elements are a part of an inability to evaluate when you hurt someone or when you
commit
an error.
But
don't think that they're running around foaming at the mouth.
Well, no, no one's thinking that. I mean, my whole point is to take all of the confusion with those words and suggest. See, the revelators are suggesting better uses of words. Humans can use the word psychopath in all kinds of ways. What I'm suggesting is we use it the way the revelation would suggest, where by definition, if you have soul disease, that means you cannot distinguish right from wrong, which means you don't have a connection to the seventh adjutant and the Holy Spirit. The only way to be able to recognize right and wrong is if you have the Holy Spirit. And you see that. I mean, psychiatrists, psychologists, do have, a sense of that notion. I mean, they try to test to see if the person actually has any notion of right and wrong in their head, or you know, do they have it, but they're choosing wrong because they know it's wrong, you know? So that's what I'm saying. I mean, you have to be disconnected from the ability, from the second cosmic intuition, you know, or otherwise it doesn't have any meaning. Okay, anyway. All right, so I just wanted, you know, I know that was a lengthy thing, but just to reflect on, see, this, you know, the greater significance of his very definitive statement about the purity of Michael, you know, his nature, what that's saying. That's the words that an iniquitous being says, a clear recognition of what good really looks like, you know, and an eloquent expression of it even. Okay?
It's interesting that it's the paradise rule that he rejects.
Right, and again, that's tied to, like I said, I mean, he's very much still vicegerent of the Universal Father. That's what everyone thinks of Michael as being, vicegerent of the Universal Father. And so, you know, you're rejecting who he's vicegerent of. You're rejecting the paradise rule. Okay, let's just stop there and let's go a little more here.
And then did this transient ruler of a rebellious system take leave of the planet of his short administrative sojourn? Well, on the third day thereafter, Michael appeared on Salvington and resumed the direction of the universe of Nebadon. There soon followed the third universal proclamation of the advancing jurisdiction of the sovereignty and authority of Michael. The first proclamation was made at the time of his arrival in Nebadon. The second was issued soon after the completion of the Melchizedek bestowal. And now the third follows upon the termination of the second Orlanonidic mission.
So that's even bringing in the 300 billion years ago. See, is the first one of those three. Who would like to read the third bestowal here? Got a reader? You want to read? These two, you know, very much go together, and you'll see that they, the next section is not totally about the third bestowal. A little bit of it is a reflection on the first three bestowals. So we get to that point, and we can step back and take a little assessment of what you have in the first three.
The third bestowal. The Supreme Council on Salvington had just finished the consideration of the call of the life carriers on planet 217 in system 87 in constellation 61 for the dispatch to their assistance of a material sun. Now, this planet was situated in a system of inhabited worlds where another system sovereign had gone astray, the second such rebellion in all Nebadon up to that time. Upon the request of Michael, action on the petition of the life carriers of this planet was deferred pending its consideration by Emmanuel and his report thereon. This was an irregular procedure, and I well remember how we all anticipated something unusual, and we were not long held in suspense. Michael proceeded to place universe direction in the hands of Emmanuel, while he entrusted command of the celestial forces to Gabriel. And having thus disposed of his administrative responsibilities, he took leave of the universe mother spirit and vanished from the dispatching field of Salvington, precisely as he had done on two previous occasions.
Gotta love that. I will remember. Yeah. And then remind yourself of how long ago this was.
It doesn't say when this occurred. Oh,
that's well, you know, the it's roughly, you know, every 100 and... Yeah.
Just 700 million years.
Yeah, it's easy to remember that far
time,
back.
He will.
You remember back then, don't you?
Well,
<remember. laughs> Can you ever really take leave of? You were just a twinkle in Michael's eye. How does he actually take leave of her in terms of?
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, the
hugging a kiss.
That's a good point. I mean, he's obviously not taking leave of her presence, but he is taking immediate leave of her personality focused presence. Remember, you know, at this point, she's a creative mother spirit, and she's definitely thicker personality-wise on Salvington than she is spread out in the universe.
Let me go experience your thin spot.
Yeah. Let me go out into the womb.
Boost it up a little.
Yes.
So does she say, are you calling me fat?
Does
it?
Does this canopy of stars make me look?
Do you see where you get it, women?
All right.
Okay. And as might have been expected, on the third day thereafter, there appeared, unannounced, on the headquarters world of System 87, in Constellation 61, strange material sun, accompanied by a lone Sakonafim, accredited by the Uversa Ancients of Days and certified by Emmanuel of Salvington. Immediately, the acting system sovereign appointed this new and mysterious material sun acting planetary prince of World 217, and this designation was at once confirmed by the most highs of the Constellation 61. Thus did this unique material son begin his difficult career on a quarantined world of secession and rebellion, located in a beleaguered system without any direct communication with the outside universe, working alone for one whole generation of planetary time. This emergency material son affected the repentance and reclamation of the defaulting planetary prince and his entire staff, and witnessed the restoration of the planet to the loyal services of the Paradise Rule as established in the local universes. In due time, a material son and daughter arrived on this rejuvenated and redeemed world. When they had been duly installed as visible planetary rulers, the transitory or emergency planetary prince took formal leave, disappearing at noon one day. On the third day thereafter, Michael appeared in his accustomed place on Salvington, and very soon the Super Universe broadcast carried the fourth proclamation of the Ancients of Days, announcing the further advancement of the sovereignty of Michael and Nebadon. I regret that I do not have permission to narrate the patience, fortitude, and skill with which this material son met the trying situations on this confused planet. The reclamation of this isolated world is one of the most beautifully touching chapters in the annals of Salvington throughout Nebadon.
Salvation
throughout Nebadon. By the end of this mission, it had become evident to all Nebadon as to why their beloved ruler chose to engage in these repeated bestowals in the likeness of some subordinate order of intelligent being.
Okay, so that there you see that last little bit. See, they're starting to hit what I mentioned they're going to talk about. Here, just in the rest of this this section, they're really starting to be affected. You know, the local universe personalities are really starting to be changed by observing and studying what happens in these bestowals. Again, it's all pretty straightforward, and not a lot there. Other than, as in the other ones, it's at the a maximization of efficiency and quality. You notice again, it's just one whole generation of planetary time. So again, it's not a very long chunk of time. It's kind of roughly in the same ballpark of time as the other two. Look what he does. He affected the repentance and reclamation of the defaulting planetary prince and his entire staff, too. Here he is. He's just a material son, doing only what the material son can do, but he does it so supremely that, the effect is complete. And it really was, that's another thing about why they mentioned what Lutentia said. Remember what Michael said when he was here, he comes not to bring families together, but he's going to split them in half. You're going to create a binary consequence. What he is so clearly good that you either definitively recognize it and adopt it, choose it because of it is good, or you reject it because it's good. He brings that kind of clarity. He sealed the deal for Lutentia by being there. It would be my guess. It's like, if there was any fuzziness left in Lutentia's mind, it was gone. He wholeheartedly chose his nothingness at that point. And here you had the prince's staff, prince and his entire staff, the other way. The whole thing, wholeheartedly, the whole planetary administration, chose the white and over the black.
So Michael goes unannounced. Nobody knows that he's going to Lutentia's system world and going to clean things up. And even Lutentia says that you're a just and merciful administrator to this person they didn't know that was Michael. Do I have it in the
Quran? Well, it did. Remember,
at that point he knew.
Yeah, remember, with the first one, the Melchizedek one, like we talked about last time, what you're thinking of, it was very, very mysterious. But it's getting more and more definitive. Like, for instance, by the time we get to the seventh bestowal, they knew way in advance, where he was going and whatnot. So, it goes from very, very mysterious to much more upfront and definitive as he goes down. Why? Because when in those upper ones, we're just about going to talk about here. It's very much for those that are functioning, up there in the local universe level. It's for. You want them to have a genuine relationship to this phenomenon. In the same way that, if you and I had been alive 2,000 years ago, we needed to recognize and choose Jesus for what he was, not because we were told in advance, about all the details. And so it was sort of just a given. It's like, well, okay, I'd be an idiot to not, just listen to whatever he says. You experientially recognize it and choose it. See, so you have that much more in play in these first ones because the celestial, beings are, the primary beneficiaries. That's why they keep emphasizing that, they're assessing him very carefully. They're not just saying, well, he's Michael, so, it's just, whatever. I mean, they're really assessing it. Is he a true Melchizedek? Let's carefully measure every dimension and make sure, is he cheating? And whatnot. I mean, they're really being critical about it. And in full critical assessment, they find it to be perfect in every way.
So, Chris,
plus the wisdom son.
When they talk about this particular sentence, I regret that I do not have permission to narrate the patient for it to be a part of this revelation. And it seems like, if we need to know, we'll be able to read, all the bestowals, the stories of how Jesus handled himself in the form of one being and another being, and part of their order. That would be fascinating to read that. So if it's important for us to know it,
It will be. It'll be.
Because he's our master.
But it would be out of time. It would, for Adam to give it to us now.
When we're ready.
Because again, we need to grow on our own. Mm-hmm. We can't be molded by fiat. Mm-hmm. If we're going to be real, we have to grow naturally.
I'm noticing a pattern, a couple of them, actually. He either disappears or appears at noon.
Right. They're starting
and then it's always on the third day.
Right, right. There's that pattern. And you've got this, part of the mystery of the incarnation is you don't have any sort of point A to point B issue here. He disappears and reappears and, he's not being transported. Everyone recognizes there's no transport going on or anything, or he's not, he's just going from point A to point B somehow. One knows how he does that.
So is the tertiary effect.
You're right. It's all very mysterious. Exactly.
You got to watch for new arrivals.
Yeah, you know, and the noon midnight thing, we talked about that last time. You know, that's always with the communication and transport. You know, it's part of the physics of it. Okay. So anyway, so you just read this next little one, and you'll see.
This little one here.
You can see the italicized word that I just alluded to there.
Yes, the sentence.
Yeah.
The bestowals of Michael as a Melchizedek son, then as a Lalanandek son, and next as a material son, are all equally mysterious and beyond explanation. In each instance, he appeared suddenly and as a fully developed individual of the bestowal group. The mystery of such incarnations will never be known except to those who have access to the inner circle of the records on the sacred sphere of Sanarrington. Secret of the bestowals.
All right, so, let's just step back a second, because you notice they listed Melchizedek, son, Lalanandek, son, material son. So just, you know, think again about what the pattern that's been in play. You know, if you remind yourself in the sheet I handed out last time, you know, which master-son likeness is he incorporating into his being in each of these? Like we mentioned last week, that first one initiates this process. You know, that's the fundamentally supremacy mode. You know, it's that father-son-like, that's Trinity of Supremacy mode that he's in there. And remember, even when Melchizedek's described his nature, you know, they pointed out that they were supreme. Mm-hmm. So that kicked off, you know, very definitively this engagement of supremacy. And so then you think about with the Lalanandek son, remember there he was literally functioning in the normal, you know, sort of mode of a Lalanandek son as a system sovereign. Okay? He was functioning as a local universe son, very definitively. Okay? And so he is this father-son-like. See, he's very much doing a father-like son mission there. He's intervening. You know, that's, you know, part of the father-likeness. He's intervening in the circumstance. And functioning very directly as a son functions. Okay? But in the third one, he's a material son, okay, but he's not literally doing the material son thing. Okay? He's intervening in the normal stream of affairs here as a minister. You know, not as a son, but as a minister. You know, he's ministering to the world, rehabilitating the prince and his staff, and he's there as a material son, so he can not only engage the prince and his staff, but he can engage the people too, all the mortals on the world. He can engage them all, minister to them all, and restore the world. Okay, see, he's in a spirit-like mode, ministry mode. There, you know. Technically, he's this material son, but you know, but the Adam and Eve, you know, come and when they arrive, you know, he leaves. See, he's not in, you know, there isn't a material daughter with him. They're not functioning in that mode. Yeah, he's not functioning in that mode. He's there so he can engage everyone. That's the beauty of being a material son in that circumstance. He can see and engage everyone there. Okay. So he can holistically minister, you know, in this supreme fashion to the whole world and restore the whole world. See? So you see, you can begin to see, even though they don't tell you a lot of the details of how he did everything, you know it's fitting into this pattern. Okay? One is a father-like son and one's a father-like minister. Okay.
It seems that his emphasis is on the ascension. He's a descending son for a period, and then he gets to be humanized and ascending son. It's all fixing that path, laying the environment so that it's all growth oriented.
Right, and in those first four, you know, they're in one of the ways, like we pointed out last time, that you really definitively see that he's descending when he's doing Master Spirit 7, Master Spirit 4, Master Spirit 5, Master Spirit 6. Why that order creates a descending phenomenon? Well, the complementary angel are in the reverse order. You know, there you go from 1, 2, 3, 4, you're in ascending order of the angels. You're going bottom up in character in the angels. See, so you know that he's going, definitively demonstrates that he's going down, because the thing that balances him is increasing in nature. You know? So, and it's very much, because it's angels, again, it's very much geared to the upper level of this phenomenon, and then the last three are very much geared to, you know, the mortal ascending. And there's not angels, you know, in that sort of definitive hierarchical fashion associated with that. You have the seraphim, like we pointed out, for number six, because you need the mother likeness. But okay.
Well, I had a question about, and I'm betting that he doesn't ever remain stationary as material son, the way Adam and Eve were stationary.
Right. See, you know, he would have had to have gone all over the planet,
yeah,
and
he doesn't remain stationary.
I mean, he's not doing any procreating. He's not doing anything like that. He's just that's a very helpful body to have to do the job that he needs to do. To engage everyone. You know, see, so that's why he said, you know, when they called for an Adam and Eve, he said, no, don't send the Adam and Eve yet. I'm going to, you know, do a little intervening thing here, you know, before the Adam and Eve show up. Yep.
One thing you said that was really interesting, he was so supremely good. He offered that spiritual healing, and those who opened up a little bit, who reached out and spiritually or figuratively, touched his garment,
right.
Were healed in that respect.
Right. Yeah, and just you know, one little thing that ties into you bringing up, you know, the material phenomenon here in the seventh bestowal. You know, again, remember when he's in that public ministry mode, the seven bestowals are technically done. I mean, he literally possesses supreme type deity at that point. That's part of what's, you know. Incarnated into Jesus at that point, he made a decision, the six great decisions. He decided he wasn't going to exercise the power that's associated with having supreme type deity. You know, that's power personality synthesis. Okay, he decided he wasn't going to exercise that. He wasn't going to begin to reveal the supreme. He was going to continue in his mode of revealing the Father, but you know. It's there, you know, and occasionally it's drawn on. The power and the personality have no separation between them, you know. And then on top of that, that zero separation between power and personality has zero separation to material energy. So it's just right there. Literally, the Supreme is stepping on the ground, you know, of this planet. And he's having to choose to not let that footstep transform the planet instantly into a Havona world or something, you know? I mean, he has to choose that. He's got all that power right there.
But he couldn't stop her.
Right, but... He knew. Right, because the personality connection, see, is there, but then the power is connected to that. You know, he can choose to not use the power directly, but he can't choose for there to be no separation between the power and the personality. Right. And so if someone makes a real personal connection...
that's what these
are. Right. So, and that's building. That's a phenomenon that's building as we go through these seven results. Yeah.
After that sixth paragraph, you know, when there's kind of a wide space, I have written in here a phase change. That must have come from you.
Or bring it back up. That's good.
Well, actually, okay.
Phase change.
Yeah, they're gonna mention that here. I'll point that out. Oh, okay. Let's read these last two paragraphs, and you'll see how they're pointing that out.
Never since this marvelous bestowal as the planetary prince of a world in isolation or rebellion have any of the material sons or daughters in Abaddon been tempted to complain of their assignments or to find fault with the difficulties of their planetary missions. For all time, the material sons know that in the Creator Son of the universe, they have an understanding sovereign and a sympathetic friend, one who has in all points been tried and tested, even as they must also be tried and tested. Each of these missions was followed by an age of increasing service and loyalty among all celestial intelligences of universe origin, while each succeeding bestowal age was characterized by advancement and improvement in all methods of universe administration and in all techniques of government. Since this bestowal, no material son or daughter has ever knowingly joined in rebellion against Michael. They love and honor him too devotedly, ever consciously to reject him. Only through deception and sophistry have the atoms of recent times been led astray by higher types of rebel personalities.
Okay, so there's two main things I wanted to point out in there. Let's do the phase change thing first. That's the beginning part of the second paragraph there that we read. Each of these three missions, see, was followed by an age of increasing service and loyalty among all celestial intelligences of universe origin. See, so these first three are the first phase. And then there's a phase change. Now, and you go into the final four. Like I said, these first three, there's a measure of it that tails over, it overlaps, and we pointed that out. If you look again, the fourth one has both a Supernathim and Gabriel. It's an overlap one. There's a little bit of the lower part going on, but then the rest of the upper part. Okay, it's during that one that you have the phase change, sort of technically, but very definitively in terms of the celestial intelligences and service and loyalty. So those first three really were the consequences of them. Remember they mentioned he's doing this because he needs to do the seven bestowals in order to become a master son, but they have consequences, lots of consequences. And the consequences of the first three are very much amongst the administration of the local universe. It's been completely transformed by these first three missions. And then you have the phase change. While each of the remaining four was characterized by advancement and improvement in all methods of universe administration and all techniques of government. Okay, so why there? Well, he's incorporating much more of the definitive creature into him, and so that's really affecting how he rules. He's leaving the ivory tower behind, if we want to use that terminology that they kind of brought up over the last
bickering starting to mellow.
Right. I mean, it's becoming more and more definitive that he knows of that which he speaks, and everyone knows it. He's leading, the ascension scheme of the mortal spheres, for instance, from a position of direct knowing. He wasn't just taught about it back in some school on Paradise with those usurpers, that they're wanting to come out here and tell us what to do. Like Lucifer was saying, those foreign potentates. Okay, and then the all tied to this is the all points have been tested and or tried and tested. That's a fun little again reference to Hebrews, the book of Hebrews, like they did in the Melchizedek one we talked about last time. They're having a great time showing how you can. Sort of turn the book of Hebrews on its head a bit and see how it has content that the authors didn't even recognize. Not only was he a priest like the order of Melchizedek, he literally was a Melchizedek in his first bestowal. And this one, actually, it might even be worth me just showing you that one, reading you that one, the words at the beginning of that one paragraph about that they're kind of touching upon here show you what they're playing off of here. If you go to Hebrews. The print is so tiny, I can hardly see it here. Let's see here. Let's see. So this one sentence in the second chapter of Hebrews starts out, "For surely it is not angels he helps." Yeah, and then it kind of, you know, does it all in point, tried and tested, you know, for our benefit. He was one of us, and so, you know, he has this complete synchronicity with us. But surely it has nothing to do with celestial intelligences. You know, what does it say there? Increasing service and loyalty among all celestial intelligences. And, of course, what's the next bestowal? It literally is an angel. Okay. See, so they're again trying to play off of the potential there in the way the author wrote the book of Hebrews, which has a lot of solid things, but, you know, it's got these blind spots too, and they're saying, well, actually, you know, not only did it have great benefit to the angels, but again, he literally was an angel in one of his bestowals.
Yeah. I'm thinking, okay, the first rebellion, everybody learned about it. Now the second rebellion comes up. Didn't they hear that song before? Don't they know what's going to happen? How can highly beings get drawn into something that's dead on arrival?
Right, and see, that again gets you back to that point I was trying to make in the beginning about iniquity. You have to appreciate this differently than humans have tended to. Jesus alluded to it when he said, "There's none so blind as those who will not see." They can see it clearly, and that's why they're choosing it. It's a willful choice of that which they know is about them. Remember, Lucifer is a child of God love? No, he's a child of self-love. Self-love. He loves himself, even though when he sees that it's utterly black, he still loves that self more than the perfectly white cosmos that he can see. There's no ignorance. See, that's the thing that's hard for, you know, the way we want to use sin now in this book is really different than the way humans have tended to use sin, you know, or try to, extrapolate it and use, you know, to the word iniquity. It's just, you got to think really differently about this. There's no ignorance involved. You know, the deeper you go into sin, the less ignorance is involved. When Lucifer was still ignorant, it was just evil. And remember, when he put forward the three principles, he was still just in the evil mode. It was later on, it finally dawned on him. He finally got his cosmic intuitions, you know, opened up enough that he could, that's not right, is it? But I've already gone public, and I'm a coward. So now I'm going to start choosing that which I know to be wrong. Okay, and initially, see, it's just that, but it grows, you know, until finally, not only am I going to choose it to not save face, I am definitively choosing it because you have no idea of the power of the dark side. This is none so blind as those who choose to not see that which, you know. See, I mean, like I said with Lutentia, he sees it. It's not that he can't see it; he sees it. Okay, but he chooses to reject it.
His statement's pretty.
You know, he chooses to close his eyes and hum.
And the mind has a infinite capacity to rationalize any negative situation.
Sure, yeah. You know, and it's very motivated if it's all about self-love. The other part of that, you have this whole bit about that they're pointing out, kind of, you know, spending a little time repeating it even, about how definitive this was, you know, on high, that so that you understand what happened with our Adam and Eve. You know, this, you know, take it out of the abstract and think about it in, you know, the definitive consequences of what they're saying here. You know, it said that that since the bestowal, this bestowal, no material son or daughter, which includes our Adam and Eve, has ever knowingly joined in rebellion against Michael. You know, and they checked that out, and they found that that was the case again with our Adam and Eve. There was, you know, not the slightest shred of knowingness. And they love and honor him too devotedly, ever consciously, to reject him. So you know, they're just, this is sort of the backstory. You know, when you read that little bit in the Adam and Eve story, when they're assessing it and then they're saying, nope, there's no rebellion here. You know, it's because of this. I mean, Michael is responsible for the fact that they didn't rebel. This bestowal, you know, led to that. He made it so that there's never going to be any material sons or daughters that rebel again. Yeah, John?
Well, it's kind of a technical question. Mm-hmm. You know, in paragraph 4, this was an emergency material son bestowal. But then in the beginning of paragraph 7, it says, never since this marvelous bestowal as the planetary prince of a world in isolation and rebellion. So why do they refer to him there as a planetary prince when he was bestowed as a material son?
Well, remember that he was functioning. So that's the thing. I mean, he was functioning temporarily as the planetary prince, but with a material son nature, you know, body, you know. Okay.
Well, I knew that he.
I mean, planetary prince is a title. Lindonadek is a being type.
Okay, so he was a material son type, functioning as a prince.
Right. You know, and of course, you know, what is he now of this planet? You know, he's a prince. And Machaventus is vicegerent planetary prince. So he's planetary prince of this world, you know, as Michael, well, as a master son, you know. Part of him being planetary prince right now is Jesus is the planetary prince of this world, in part, because he's still Jesus now as much as he was then. So that's even more than a material son being planetary prince. A mortal is planetary prince. Okay, so we'll move on to the next one here then next week, and again, it's a great spot to stop because, like Joan pointed out, there's a phase change here.
Can I throw out a question?
Yep. Yeah, sure.
Just this statement. Mm-hmm. It's kind of has me puzzled.
Mm-hmm.
This emergency material son affected the repentance and reclamation of the defaulting planetary prince and his entire staff, mm-hmm. and witnessed the restoration of the planet to the loyal service of the paradise rule as established in the local universes. What has me a little bit puzzled is they wouldn't regard Lutentia's rejection and spurning as his failure. Why is it that you would regard this as his success?
I'm saying they wouldn't regard.
They wouldn't regard Lutentia spurning his trying to reclaim him.
Oh, okay.
In the second bestowal, as Jesus' failure, as Michael's failure.
Oh, okay.
Why would they regard this as his success when, again, it's a matter of the choice of those involved?
Yeah. That's kind of related to that comment I made about I didn't come to bring families together. I came to split them in two. He successfully bifurcated, you know, the situation. His success is in this clearly shining the light of truth on the circumstance, so that which is black shows itself to be black, and that which is white shows itself to be white, and there's no gray. That's his success. And that reminds you a bit of that whole conversation we had with lots of back and forth about the nature of the Supreme and how, the Supreme is the source of this binary phenomenon. Either you choose to be real, and if you do, you're upheld by the mother side of the Supreme, or you choose to not be real, and then you blend in to the almighty side of the Supreme. You know, by you, I mean, the energy of yourself, just blends into that. So you have this the Supreme is a pattern for the whole finite age here, and you see it again here. And it's not surprising when he's really engaging supremacy that would be very definitively in play. Choose this day whom you will serve. It's a binary choice. At some point, if you're going to be part of the Supreme's domain, there's only two choices. Wholehearted blackness or wholehearted whiteness. And that's the only two choices. And when he comes in, if he successfully creates that choice, I mean, if he manifests that choice, he's successful. I mean, I think that's part of what's going on. There may be lots of other things that I can't think of off the top of my head right now, but that immediately comes to mind.
There's a certain amount of you had to be there, but the other thing that comes to mind for me is, when you were saying he's here as a planetary, he's here as a material sun, he's embodied as a material sun,
right.
But he's functioning as a planetary prince. Still, in order for the material suns to be responding that way, they have to be recognizing that Michael is functioning entirely as a material sun,
right?
Doing the planetary prince role,
right? Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And I mean that's a pretty audacious thing because a material sun is a system being, and the Lunatic sun, who normally does the role, has origin at the top of the local.
Even as a reserve, he's at the constellation level.
It's kind of interesting just to
kind of foreshadowing a lowly primitive human who transformed the entire super universe. I think his name was Amadon. Just because you're only a material son doesn't mean you can't do great things. If you actually use the gift that's been given you, the personality gift from the Father, we would all be amazed at what kind of harmony we could weave. If we use that potential to unify the threefold actuality and create harmony, if we use that personal creativity, you have personal creativity. And he's most effective in the application of that personal creativity when he's fully aware of the logical consistency of the circumstance. That was one of the points I brought out in that talk I gave. You need to weave the two together, and if you do, you'll be startled at how successful you'll be. If you try to just do the father thing without recognizing the mother, you're not going to be anywhere near as successful. And you're also likely to only hold it together while you're actually holding it. And the second you let go, it'll just unravel.
Over and over again, but it bears making it over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
The whole point of this paper is you don't understand Jesus of Nazareth unless you understand that he did these six other bestowals.
Right. Like I mentioned, if you don't understand that he now is in possession of supreme deity, you don't really get what he's doing with the six great decisions. I mean, he's not making some sort of strange arbitrary decisions. He's literally is saying, I could now reveal God the Supreme in my measure, and I'm not going to do that. You know, and you just, like you're saying, unless you understand what's going on here, you just don't appreciate that. And that's just one of a billion things like that in the life and teachings of Jesus. All right, let's take a moment here, and since we brought up that personal creativity, reflect on that when we do our little final meditation here.